Here we go gathering nuts in May, nuts in May, nuts in May. Here we go gathering nuts in May on a cold and frosty morning. Whoops!
Hi, everyone, and welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and my blog is cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And my name is Andrew, and my blog is thestopbutton.com.
And this is our little podcast where we talk about a pair of movies, a double feature usually, and this double feature is Invisibility. It's The Invisible Man from 1933, the original Universal monster movie, and 1992's Memoirs of an Invisible Man, directed by John Carpenter, starring Chevy Chase. So there's a lot to talk about there, but as we usually do, we'll address things chronologically. I think this might only be the second time I've seen Invisible Man. I saw it once when I was a kid, but it's so good. I think I literally remember every second of it from when I was a kid because it's kind of just amazingly flawless. And yeah. It's James Whale. I don't know if this is the first movie he did after Bride of Frankenstein or before it, but it's kind of between the Frankensteins. And it's just as good as Bride in its own way. What's really interesting to think of now, though, is that in The Invisible Man is not much of a monster. He's more of just a psychopath, and he's a scientist who made himself invisible. So it's more like a science fiction thriller than it is, I don't know, anything as, you know, with the gothic romanticism of Dracula and Frankenstein. I mean, he's a guy who made a thing that turned him invisible. So it's got that going for it, which makes it more unique, even though it, you know, gets lumped into the universal horror cycle of movies in that category, and because it's from the director of Frankenstein. But it's really close to the book. I read the book for the first time in like the last year, and I was surprised at how closely the movie follows it. And there's some quote from this attributed to the screenwriter saying, like, you know, there were all these treatments at Universal, like it taking place in foreign countries and stuff. And then I just read the book and I was like, oh, well, we should just do this. And it's a very faithful adaptation. I think what it adds is sort of more, it sort of makes it better, if anything, because, The Invisible Man doesn't have as much personality in the book, and in the movie he's played, you know, kind of unforgettably by Claude Rains, who's this theatrical actor who you assume must be, like, you know, have been in a ton of movies before this, or at least silent movies, and he wasn't. They just, like, plucked him right from the stage for this, and he had a film career afterwards, but it's this totally, I mean, you know, there's a kind of famous image of the Invisible Man as this guy being all bandaged up, sort of like a mummy, but with a fake nose and a hat and weird glasses. He spends the movie, you know, when you see him, that's how he looks. And it's this totally physical performance that's mesmerizing. Yeah. And then the kicker is that when he's invisible, all the practical effects with the, you know, which are just like flying objects, but they're perfectly timed flying objects. And you're listening to Claude Rains, you know, move around the room. You buy it, which is like stunning for a movie from 1933 with, you know, special effects at that time, including kind of the first blue screen special effect. Apparently they did it with black velvet, like velvet on velvet, but it was like the first kind of practical or optical effect like that. And yeah, it looks really good. So it just works on every level.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the special effects is that with the velvet, I don't remember seeing that again for years, right? Like, there were matte shots, like in King Kong and so Mighty Joe Young and about 15 years after that, except there were never any Universal horror movies with such complicated special effects as this one.
Yeah.
And that's like part of the surreal aspect of The Invisible Man is during the non velvet screen parts, you're kind of sitting there and you can sort of understand how they must have done the effects. Like, they must have had like a wire frame around the, like, because he'll unravel his head, his bandages, and then they cut to this, you know, head that has the eye holes in it. So, but there's no, you never see any wires, you never see anything. I mean, it's just amazing special effects for 1933. And
yeah. And sort of like from today, you can look at it and think more about how they did it, but it still looks authentic.
Yeah.
Like in the context of the rest of the movie, you know, it all being in black and white, I'm sure doesn't hurt the illusion, but just because of the direction and the acting and everything else just works in synchronicity. It's just like, you know, last time we talked about Jurassic Park, I think we were saying, oh, you know, that's a movie that shows that it's the director, not the, you know, in equal measure as the quality of the special effects.
Right.
That's why the CG in that kind of looks better. But yeah, I mean, special effects aside, it's got this, the storyline is kind of almost a little too creaky and old fashioned for its own good, because the Invisible Man has, like, you know, his fellow scientist's daughter is in love with him. I don't believe that was in the book. I think that's a fairly conventional Hollywood cliche to have added at the time. And the girl who plays his fiance is just worse than useless. I was kind of stunned as to, or like, there's uncredited writers, I think, on the Wikipedia entry for this movie that aren't on IMDb, but one of them is Preston Sturges. Another of them is Philip Wiley, who's a kind of now obscure author of like this amazing anti-American culture tract from the 50s called Generation of Vipers. And it's also very much against what Philip Wiley called momism, which was sort of like the encroaching feminization of the American male in post-war United States. So maybe that's why the Invisible Man's fiance is such a twit. But besides that, it's got this really cool structure where the beginning, much like in the novel, is the Invisible Man shows up at a old English inn. And there's really no characters except for the innkeepers and the pub crawlers and the, you know, Invisible Man upstairs. And then there's the big scene where he takes off his bandages and reveals himself. And that's about like 20 minutes into the movie. And he runs off and he's invisible. But then and it's a really short movie. It's an hour and 10. So at 20 minutes in, the Invisible Man escapes and he goes and he finds this old partner of his, a scientist colleague named Kemp, and proceeds to psychologically torture him for the rest of the movie. It's kind of more horrifying than anything that's ever been done to anyone by Dracula or Frankenstein or the Wolfman, because it's just terrifying. Basically, Kemp is this guy who just looks like a, you know, kind of pudgy, unappealing, charmless William Powell, and the Invisible Man just kind of arbitrarily decides, like, you know, you're going to be my partner in crime, because if you don't, I'll kill you. And, you know, the whole incident at the inn kind of left him rattled, and now he's bent on world domination. And they, you know, write it off as saying that the invisibility formula is making him go crazy. But it's not just that he makes him go crazy. He's not just like going around randomly murdering people. He's megalomaniacal and he wants to rule the world. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it, because what can, you know, one man do? But when you've got Claude Rains making these grand speeches,
yeah,
about, you know, the power of invisibility, and he who controls about the invisibility controls the universe, you kind of buy it. And so you have this guy Kemp who's just forced to be under house arrest with the Invisible Man and listen to his speeches and listen to his death threats, and then be his partner in crime for a little bit, and then try to attract the police, and then be found out by the Invisible Man, and then he doesn't get killed there. Spoiler alert. the Invisible Man says, "I'm going to kill you tomorrow night."
At
10 o'clock. And he lets him go into the custody of the police. And then, you know, sure enough, 24 hours later, when Kemp is driving away, you know, he suddenly hears the Invisible Man's voice from the back seat. And then it doesn't end there. And then he like straps him into a car and describes how the car is going to crash and burn at the bottom of a hill and he's going to die slowly. And then he goes, "Well, off you go." And then he drives him off the cliff and laughs maniacally.
Yeah.
And the maniacal laughter is something else, because he does it a lot, basically as when he loses his mind and he strips in front of the crowd. But it's James Whale, okay, and like, you know, just like the little girl in Frankenstein gets thrown in the river, and in Bride of Frankenstein, you know, that had its own kind of mean streak. The mean streak in The Invisible Man is that shortly after The Invisible Man runs out of the inn and after the first 20 minutes, he pushes over a baby carriage. Like, it happens really quickly, but he pushes over a baby carriage and he's like, "Oh, pardon me, madam," and goes on his merry way. And he's just a dick. Like, he's funny. That's the thing. Like, when he's not being terrifying, he's just a total asshole. But he's a murderous one. The scene that kind of infuses the two is, okay, after he's ran off and hid at Kemp's house for a night, the next day, like, you know, the town constable is listening to everyone, and, you know, he doesn't believe him. He says, "Invisible Man, you know, it's just a hoax, phooey." And then his inkwell gets thrown in his face, and his face is spattered with ink. And everybody panics, and the Invisible Man, and they run out of the room. And then, like, that's all well and good and funny and everything, but then he strangles the policeman, going, "Oh, so I'm a hoax, am I?" And it would have been funny if they just let it at the ink in the face, but then he strangles him. That's kind of the Invisible Man in a scene for you.
Well, they do that at the beginning, too, where they make the innkeepers obnoxious and unlikable, and then proceed to make the Invisible Man, you know, worse.
Yeah, your sympathy is on his side just a little bit, because he's just checking into this inn to try to find a cure, and then they won't leave him alone. Why can't they leave him alone? Oh, because he's not paying rent, I guess. Well, there you go.
Yeah, well,
But there's no other character yet. It's just, you know, the Invisible Man and the annoying townspeople. So by the time he takes off his bandages and, you know, "All right, you fools, you know, you want to see it?" And you're kind of on his side a little.
Yeah, because the when he comes in, the opening shot is him in a storm, in a snowstorm. And then so he's cold. He's, you know, he comes into this into the inn, which is a lot like, I wonder if James or John Landis.
Yeah, American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does have a strong vibe there.
But so he comes in and everybody's like really weirded out by him. And then they clarify they're weirded out by him because of his bandages. And you're just kind of like, well, that's kind of jerky. Like, you know, they're like, "Oh, he must be a burn victim." And it's just like,
right.
Well, why are you harassing him for being a burn victim? And then the woman goes up, and she sees him. And that's the first time the audience gets to see the shot where he doesn't have a mouth.
Yeah.
And she,
like,
misses
your first
it.
Little glimpse of him. Right?
Yeah. And her, you know, he's freaking out because she sees him. And her response is to go downstairs and talk about how, like, even his head's bandaged. So, yeah. And she's the housemaid in Bride of Frankenstein.
Una O'Connor.
Yeah.
Is this little lady who has this really annoying gimmick of screaming at the top of her lungs, and it's supposed to be to comic effect. It's probably the one thing in the movie that's not so good, much like Claude Rains' fiance. But unlike Claude Rains' fiance, it's harder to ignore Una O'Connor. But yeah, she did the same screaming bit in Frankenstein.
Yeah. And so she's supposed to be somewhat annoying, and it gives you the sympathy.
It's kind of amazing she doesn't get killed by him later. He had a chance, but he went for the policeman.
Yeah. And so that's one of the other funny parts is that not funny like haha, but just how strange it is that at a certain point it he's killed people, yet all of his friends are not his not Kemp. Kemp is freaking out, but Dr. Cranley and the girl they're still in support of him, even though he's, you know, he caused a train accident and he
Yeah, because Kemp can't tell them yet that he's being held hostage by Griffin. But yeah, eventually he, you know, brings the father and the daughter over, and the daughter has her scene with Rains. And that's kind of the odd thing too, is like they give him, even after he's shown to be a murderous megalomaniacal bastard, they let him have his romantic scene with his fiance eventually. And then he promptly, you know, escapes and dicks around with some policemen. And then it's kind of like a manhunt movie for the rest. Oh, but he hasn't killed Kemp yet. So, but then even after he kills Kemp, like he has a deathbed scene. And it's kind of their way of, like, you know, getting to show you Claude Rains at the end, because that's the last shot of the movie is him rematerializing after he's dead. But they still give him a bedside scene with the fiance where he talks about how he tampered in God's domain. And I don't know, I guess a scene like that or dialogue was like that was obligatory at that time for mad scientist movies, for them to renounce their ways and for tampering with God's will at the end.
There's a scene earlier where she's distraught and she's got his picture and they don't show you his picture. And so I had actually forgotten that he showed up at the end. When I was watching it, you notice when they're dealing with how they talk about the character that, Wales really going out of his way to tease the idea that he might not show you what the actor looks like. And in a lot of ways, it's identical to what they did with Boris Karloff in the first Frankenstein, where they use the opening titles to sort of play with the viewer's expectation.
Oh, the question mark credited to the monster.
With this one, they're like Claude Rains, the invisible one. So,
They call him the invisible one.
Like,
in
you might
titles.
Not see him, you know.
Yeah. I thought when I read the invisible one as having a more magisterial ring to it, more than like an offhanded, he's the invisible one.
Yeah,
if you see an invisible guy, that's him. But then they do end credits and he's Claude Rains, the invisible man.
Yeah, and I mean, so you mentioned the structure a little, but so it opens with the inn.
Yeah.
Then we cut to, like, I think I can recite the entire plot. that you open with the inn, you cut to the family, the colleagues and fiance, cut back to the inn for the big reveal where he gets kicked out, which goes to the town. And then he ends up at Kemp's, and you're maybe, what, half hour, 35 minutes into the movie? So it's almost, in some ways, it's almost over. And they've gotten all this stuff done in just regular scenes. So, like,
yeah.
when he gets to the inn, you have no background on him, and it's probably like a 10-minute scene just introducing him there. And then when they're talking about him, you start to piece it together, and I mean, it's just awesome. And it had me looking up what else the RC Sheriff had written, because Frankenstein is all of the other Universal horror movies, except maybe The Mummy. And I can't remember for sure. They're kind of messy in how they're structured.
I wrote a Goodbye, Mr. Chips, the 39 version.
Yeah. And, He looks like he was British because he ended up writing a lot of British stuff later in his career.
Oh, and the beloved British war movie, The Dam Busters.
Right. So, yeah. He did a lot of stuff. He did Journey's End with James Whale directing and Colin Clive in it in 30, which got adapted a bunch of times. So it stands out from the other Universal horror movies in that way too, that...
Yeah, well, it's not based on a gothic novel. It's based on an H.G. Wells book, although they managed to make a pretty scary movie out of another H.G. Wells book, which we might be talking about in the next episode. But yeah, it's so many things. It's funny, and sometimes it is genuinely scary. I mean, it's got this high science fiction concept, but they make it scary just by having him kill people and by, well, Kemp again. Just to friggin' give the guy some credit here, William Harrigan was not in much else, but he takes this incredibly thankless role and he really makes him this figure to project all your fear onto, because his situation seems so hopeless, and you keep putting yourself in his shoes. Like, if I knew there was an invisible man in the room, what would I try to do? Would I try to go for him? You know, would I try to get away? You know, it personalizes it. I mean, you can't. It's kind of like an invisible man wouldn't be frightening if he were just attacking people, because he'd be caught. But if he has intelligence, then, you know, he could be in the room spying on you. So they kind of, whatever. I mean, that's stuff that H.G. Wells figured out, I guess, when he wrote the story. But the funny thing about the story, maybe, is that it's not a story of espionage, which we're almost getting to. it's not, which would be like the natural thing for it. And that's what he's talking about when he's making speeches about the power of invisibility and how you can rule the world with it. But it just kind of posits that if one guy had found the secret of invisibility, he would pretty quickly go nuts with it. But oh, and the other thing about the transition from book to novel or book to movie is the book actually had like a scientific explanation that Wells concocted based on like the reflection of light and how that's where we, you know, how we see things. So if you can just get cells to not reflect light, you know, that was what the chemical did. But I don't know, they didn't have time for that.
This was something about some material that made things pale. Remember,
I think I noticed it. Because like when they talk about science in this movie, it sounds really stilted. It's like I created my secret of invisibility with chemicals. Oh.
Yeah, say. Maybe some radiation thrown in there, wow, too. Yeah.
But I guess in 33, people would murmur to, oh, chemicals. Oh.
Yeah.
So what else is great in this? Well, he flips over the baby carriage. That's awesome. He strangles the policeman. He terrorizes Kemp.
He makes time to rob the bank.
That's part of that twisted sense of humor in the movie is he throws around wads of bills from a stack that he stole from the bank going, here you go, money, 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 money. right, but like he has this reign of terror idea, so he's going to cause – you see him causing train crashes and stuff. And then, yeah, he mixes it up by also courting the people's favor. The more you think about it, it's like the less it makes sense that an invisible man could run the world or even like successfully extort a large sum of money from a government, let's say, as a mere terrorist. But again, you kind of buy it because of how Raines describes it.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't work without Claude Raines, and he
gets away with it for a while, but that's kind of the neat thing about the ending. And the ending is straight from the book. Like it just becomes a manhunt. It just becomes they're chasing him. They're tracking him in the snow. They see his footprints in the snow. They fire off a few shots and they got him. So it's got a nicely kind of down pat ending, or I don't know, unspectacular ending. Like, he doesn't have to go out in a huge fireball or anything.
No, he's sleeping in a barn and he gets busted. It's just, yeah.
And he's naked. And they mention that in the dialogue. And I think that's kind of a slightly pre-code thing, or the year the code went into effect, that you can just toss off a line about, like, you know, it's, you know, I am cold. I'm naked. Or it's hard to get around when you're naked all the time.
We can't forget that when we start talking about the next one. Yeah.
Well, they worked their way around that.
Yes, they did.
But the Invisible Man is the only naked monster in the monster family. He is
a creature from the Black Lagoon would be naked.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, and then they didn't
remember,
make any...
You ever read The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Yeah, yeah, how they handle that, yeah.
Yeah, Alan Moore's rendition of, I think he calls him Eddie Griffin. In that version.
Yeah.
He really retains the bastardry, though. Like, when they introduce him in that comic, he's raping schoolgirls at a private academy somewhere, before Alan Quatermain and Mina Harker tear him off. And then he betrays the group to the Martians in the sequel. It's like, you know, a Wells crossover to War of the Worlds. And then Mr. Hyde can see him all the time. So he buggers him to death. You know, for our non-comics fans, if you're a fan of classic Victorian literary characters incorporated into thrilling comic narratives involving buggery, then yeah, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But don't see the movie with Sean Connery. It's terrible. It has nothing to do with the comics.
What I find interesting is they did make sequels eventually to The Invisible Man.
Yeah, it took them a while.
Yeah.
The first one was like, what, 40?
Yeah, 41? It was 40, and they were doing them as B-movies, so they had 2 and 40. They had Invisible Agent, they had Invisible Man's Revenge. Yeah, they had a lot of them, and I've never actually seen any of them.
Yeah, and they're all different. They're not Griffin. He's not back from the dead. They're just different Invisible Mans, like there's different Jawses.
Yeah, and it looks
and
like...
The Invisible Man Returns is Vincent Price as the voice of the Invisible Man, right?
Oh, is it?
Yes, it is. And, Price also cameos as the Invisible Man's voice at the in the very final scene of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
And then they did made an Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man. I think Claude Rains probably became too legitimate for them to sequelize it. Maybe, I don't know. It's a weird. It's almost like they didn't exploit the property.
Well, in The Invisible Man Returns, the guy who becomes invisible is an innocent man wrongly convicted. So the story is about him, you know, it's a thriller. The way
right.
that, you know, I mean, I describe Invisible Man 33 as a science fiction thriller, but I guess it's more of a science fiction horror, if you can describe it as that. But it's, you know, it's just that even though it's something otherworldly and fantastical, it's grounded in reality by the fact the Invisible Man is just a guy. But probably in the other Invisible Man films that they made, if the Invisible Man Returns is any precedent, you know, they figured it was easier to have him be a neutral party or the protagonist. Because I remember seeing The Invisible Man meets Abbott and Costello as a kid, and he was like a boxer. And there's a scene where Costello is pretending to box while the Invisible Man hits the punching bag for him, and all the reporters are like, wow, look at how good he is. But so, you know, the Invisible Man 33 takes on the task of making the Invisible Man a bad guy, which you need to have it be, I guess, as exciting as it can be. Although it has been a while since I've seen Hollow Man.
Oh, it's so bad. Oh, it's so bad. yeah. So bad. Which I guess, unless you have anything else, can be our segue to discussing the first CG Invisible Man movie, if Hollow Man was the second.
Oh, wow. Was it really?
In 92.
All right.
When doing CG wasn't doing what Jurassic Park did, but doing what T2 did, which is an interesting year if you think about it. So now you have not seen Memoirs of an Invisible Man, is that correct?
No, I have seen it once before, and I think it was so that we could talk about it when we started the Alan Smithy podcast for the John Carpenter retrospective episode. And I guess when I saw it then, I was sort of primed to hate it, but I probably enjoyed it more now, as much as you can enjoy it, than I did back then. Just sort of wistfully. Maybe it's because we've been watching so many bad movies with Chevy Chase lately. But I see this as in kind of a continuum from Fletch Lives and Caddyshack 2.
It sort of is like Fletch 3. I mean, they do the narration.
I was thinking that they do, as it started. The first person voiceover from Chase. You can almost hear the Faltemeyer music.
Yeah. And okay, so I think I probably talked a little about this on the John Carpenter episode. But yeah, I saw this at a sneak preview when I was I was 13. So I don't think I'd ever seen any John Carpenter yet. I mean, I knew what Halloween was, what Big Trouble in Little China was. But I was at that point before I would have been seeing movies because they were John Carpenter movies. And by the time I was seeing movies because they were John Carpenter movies, it didn't occur to me to ever see Memoirs of an Invisible Man again. And I must have at some point maybe...
Well, it is sort of at some point what?
I probably saw it on VHS. But you really can't because it's
well, it's widescreen.
Well,
you know,
it's widescreen. It's wide, but he really amps up the widescreen quality during the romance scenes, which I found very weird. That well, you know, he really does try to do a. I mean, the thing
it's
is,
like,
is,
yeah.
It's not good, and there are lots of things that don't work about it. Like Carpenter does not have any commentary on the yuppie, late 80s yuppie thing.
Well, it's not really a Carpenter movie because it's not even John Carpenter's Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Maybe they were afraid people were just going to read John Carpenter's memoirs and think it was going to be a, you know, story of his USC days or something. But, you're right. It's not a John Carpenter's movie, and I don't believe he's ever done that with any other titles. I mean, even Christine, which he says in every interview he did because the thing was such a bomb and he needed to do something commercial. Even that has his name on it, but this doesn't. And it have been his first movie since They Live, I think.
Yeah,
four years earlier. So even though it was kind of – and that was like a long – probably his longest break from movies ever or second longest considering how prolific he was throughout the decade. So he didn't really want to make this his debut, I guess. You know, he just took this to show that he could do another commercial job, but he must not have – well, I guess it just wasn't his movie. That's the thing. It's like it feels like a Chevy Chase movie. There's like three producers on it. And one of them is Chase's producer, like of the Chevy Chase show, which came out the same year as this.
Ooh.
If America needed two really good reasons to be sick of him. But I know that would have been Nothing But Trouble, but that came out slightly before this. Anyways, yeah, it's not a John Carpenter movie. I mean, I assume his creative input on this was kind of perfunctory. Just, you know.
Well, the opening.
Oh, except for the casting of Sam Neill, you know, because we know how much he loves him when he brought him back for Mouth of Madness. The opening, yes.
When there are these vans going through San Francisco, and you see the interior and it's all the technology that felt very Carpenter-y. when you see the wireframe of the building. It felt more Carpenter-y than anything else, because even though he does
guys standing around in rooms full of computers looking at the screens, sure. Yeah.
Even when he, you know, then he does the whole romance thing, and he, you know, you can't watch that pan and scan because he puts the two actors on opposite sides and, you know, plays with the space, and, you know, he really tries. And it's weird because we don't now. Carpenter just gave some interview where he's like, yeah, I'm not never gonna make a movie again, you know, he's always been saying, oh, maybe I'll make a movie again. They made The Ward, and apparently that didn't convince him he wanted to come back. It's almost like he was doing an audition for mainstream work. And I remember I read in Starlog about him doing this, and he was saying, you know.
Well, you know what was another more successful audition for mainstream work was Starman, and that was still John Carpenter's Starman, I think.
It was, but the difference is that was who produced that, Michael Douglas, not, you know, Chevy Chase.
Yeah. I don't know. Here's the thing I didn't know about Memoirs of an Invisible Man. It was a high-profile project, not because of Chevy Chase, but, like, the novel was sold for, like, $4 million.
Really?
To be made into a movie? Yeah, the guy who wrote the novel, it's literally the only novel he's ever written. He's been, like, living off the money he made from selling the movie rights ever since. So it must be a pretty damn good novel. It came out in 87 by H.F. Saint. And, you know, Carpenter, huge science fiction fan. I mean, you know, They Live credits the short story 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know, it's presumable he read the novel, liked it, and said, you know, sure, I'll do the movie. But I don't know. Was it Chevy Chase getting attached to it that made him take his name off of it?
I think on the IMDb trivia page it says he didn't even ask because he knew Warner would say no.
Didn't even ask to put his name on it?
That Carpenter didn't even, and it's not there. There isn't, like, it's a John Carpenter film, I don't think. I think it really does come at the very end, just directed by John Carpenter. He clearly met people on it. Yeah, he met Sam Neill. He met Lawrence G. Paul, who did the production design for Escape from L.A. Shirley Walker did music with Carpenter.
I really didn't like her score. It sounds like a 90-minute episode of Batman the Animated Series. And it doesn't quite sell the adventure, because Chevy Chase is just antithetical to any sense of excitement they're trying to generate. I'll just get that out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of the thing, is it feels dated because it's I don't know if the book is, but it seems at one point they're like, well, you know, he's well off, but he doesn't work hard. He doesn't have any family. He doesn't have any friends. He's not married. You know, oh, he's like a real invisible man anyway. You know, and it's like a commentary on being a white stockbroker in the late 80s or something. But
yeah, I'm sure the novel had more to do with that.
And, you know, Carpenter has zero interest in that, just none whatsoever. You can just tell, you know, and Chevy Chase doing it is stupid because, like, he's not quite as goofy as he was, like, in Fletch 2 or in the Caddyshack 2, but it's still, in some ways, I'm sitting there watching it thinking to myself, I wonder if even with everything else, if they just changed out Michael Keaton in this role, would it have...
Oh, it would have been so good.
It would have been,
This is the only... I've never watched a movie, like, running through a catalog of actors in my head. Like, who could have made this movie work? Like, if it was just anybody but Chevy Chase, you watch it and you can't stop thinking about him. And if it's a scene where you're just hearing his voice, then it's Fletch narrating. And... but we got to talk about something this movie does, which is it's an Invisible Man movie where you can see the Invisible Man and nobody else can, which sounds like it could work in theory, maybe if it was, you know, Michael Keaton doing it. But with Chase, it's like it's just – isn't that kind of what he does in his movies anyways? Like he sneaks into the hospital and Fletch just sort of unnoticed. And it just – it's just too much comedy. I mean, like there's – the movie keeps alternating back and forth between scenes where it's funny that he's invisible and scenes where he could get killed.
And I kind of like in the The Invisible Man, where I was like, oh, you sit there and you're like, wow, how'd they do those effects? There are a few scenes in here where the not necessarily Chase, but his co-stars are really impressive in how they act when they're supposed to be ignoring him. You know, so there are a couple moments like that, but it's and so is that Chase's ego?
I don't know. I'll do your Invisible Man movie, but I have to be visible.
Because it's not something that you can really see Carpenter being like, no, I think the problem with this is that, you know, he's not visible to us. And also in the IMDb trivia was that – so William Goldman gets the final screenwriting credit of the three. And apparently they didn't use it. He's never seen it, so he doesn't know what they used. But they wanted to do like an adventure romance, and he just thought it was going to be a comedy or something. So he quit and they brought in, you know, the two kind of hacky writers that they brought in. So yeah, it's just, it's a mess. Yeah.
Dana Olsen and Robert Collector.
Yeah. Robert Collector, who, what did he write? Like Red Heat or Raw Deal or something like that.
Olson, writer of The Burbs and George of the Jungle and Inspector mm-hmm. Gadget.
Mm-hmm. So,
all right, well,
she handled the comedy and he handled the action. I mean, I'm sure that's what the deal was. And
yeah, some of the differences between the book and the movie are interesting, according to Wikipedia. Like the accident at the science lab that causes the invisibility. In the novel, it's a group of Marxist student protesters demonstrating nuclear catastrophe by attempting to explode a cat. The movie is actually just as goofy, but it's stupider because Chevy Chase like walks by and asks somebody where the bathroom is, and a scientist knocks a cup of coffee onto a console, and it makes the entire building explode, and the invisibility device goes off. So it's a bit more to swallow. It's like a Chevy Chase movie is fighting for control with a real movie, and neither one can come out dominant.
But it does move well, and that's one of the things I kind of remembered about it. And that's what had me thinking about Hollow Man, is that Invisible Man movies sort of have to move well because there's got to be a cool effects moment every 5 minutes or so, maybe 10.
Yeah.
And Hollow Man didn't have that.
I was thinking Memoirs of an Invisible Man doesn't have that almost enough because
it doesn't have it enough, but it still has it. Like the jogging gag, you know. And the other thing is, since it
they ripped off Ghostbusters too.
Yeah. Since it is CG, it's less interesting.
It's that early. It's that, you know, it's CG that's dated well, but in this movie, actually, which is sort of commendable by itself. But yeah, you can't have a sense of wonder about it now because you see the gum being chewed and, you know, it's just a little piece of digitalia there. Or chunks of the building missing, which is, you know, a neat image, but you know how it's done now.
Yeah, and I feel like, I mean, there really have only been two CG invisible movies that I can think of. And it just might not be a genre that lends itself to needing that special effect.
Yeah, I feel like this would have been a better movie if they had committed totally to not being able to see the Invisible Man. Like, that would have been more stronger.
Oh, we didn't talk about the clothes yet. Okay, so that's the other thing is that unlike Hollow Man, unlike the Invisible Man, since it's not a potion, since the guy has been, his cells have been irradiated with invisibility, it also changed the cells of his clothes. So he has an outfit that is invisible. So he doesn't have to wear any kind of clothes around. Like one of the dumbest things in it is that he can only eat clear foods because the sight of himself digesting complex foods makes him throw up.
Oh, that's such a Chevy Chase line. It's such a, hey, I've got a great idea for a scene kind of Chevy Chase moment where he orders clear food when he's ordering takeout. You know, water, gelatin.
Why doesn't he wear a sweater? He wouldn't be able to see it because he already has clothes on. So it's... And then they try really hard to, like, rationalize his relationship with the girl. And
it's absurd. They had sex in a bathroom when they met, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, they have this one-night stand. And, yeah, and then she doesn't mind this guy coming back invisible. In fact, she's going to have his baby, his invisible baby.
Yeah, it ends with the invisible baby. And that raises the question, of course, that it probably shouldn't actually affect his reproductive system because
it's just sort of insane. Like, imagine a movie about this family of invisible people living on a snow-capped mountain.
Oh, I'm sure
it would be the craziest thing ever.
Well, no, because it could have been a new vacation series where they're invisible.
Invisible vacation.
Invisible vacation, and they would have. Yeah,
I would say that. my brain cells were dying as I tried to choke out the words. Invisible vacation.
I don't know that you can explain Chevy Chase's, not his popularity because it had waned by this point, but Hollywood continuing to be in the Chevy Chase business after what would be the last reasonable time to be in the Chevy Chase business? Spies Like Us? I mean.
Yeah, and what was his swan song, really? The Cops and Robbersons? That was like, what, 94?
Well, yeah, that was his swan song, but Cops and Robertsons probably didn't cost any money. This cost money. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. No, this was a huge bomb.
Yeah.
And, it's not hard to see why. Because really, how do you gauge the public's appetite for Invisible Man movies? When is it time? How do you know? I hate to say it, but maybe the first did it best. Maybe there was really nothing else to improve on because with a full range of CG, invisibility, you know, special effects, what have we seen in this or Hollow Man that was worth seeing?
Yeah, I really think that – oh, no. Dang it, that's right. Okay, so I don't know if we've done the Chevy – I'm sure we did during the Fledge episodes, but – so, no, Three Amigos was 86, so that sort of, you know, propped him up for a while, let him do Funny Farm, which bombed, but then he did Christmas Vacation. Christmas Vacation was huge, so I'm sure that carried him over through this, and then Cops and Robbersons was his next movie after this. That's kind of incredible, and then by that was it. Then he did
that was a couple of years later, but this was the same year that infamous Chevy Chase show had its run. I mean, I think conceivably, well, this movie came out in February. When was the Chevy Chase show on the air? But conceivably, you could be watching like a rerun of, you know, you could be watching this at a dollar theater and then coming home and the Chevy Chase show is on the air and then you blow your brains out. Chevy Chase show air dates. I mean, you know, whatever. He's not horrible, but that's the rub. He's never really, like, abrasive. He's just kind of bland and irritating. And I don't know. It's not what he does in this movie. He's kind of like not vulnerable enough in this movie. Like you hear his voiceover talking about like, you know, I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep, you know, and you're just kind of not buying it because he's so, his personality and everything else is so smarmy that it's hard to believe any kind of drama that he's going through.
They change his character to include the whole womanizing thing, which they don't establish early on. It's, it needed, I almost feel like, had it been made in like the late 80s, like right after Warner bought the book. Mm-hmm. Well, Ivan Reitman was originally attached to it, and he quit, I think because he didn't want Chevy Chase in it, and they had wanted it to be a Chevy Chase vehicle. I just feel like if it had been made in the late 80s when, you know, it would have been like ILM or something crazy doing the practical effects.
Yeah, well, they would have gone nuts with it, and they wouldn't have felt obligated to have the half and half to be able to see him, because that's just, it just feels like a cop out. If it was all that, then it would be something conceptual, but because it's like half that and half getting to see the invisibility, it feels like kind of a cheat, because you're just waiting for the next invisibility shot,
right?
Oh, when's it coming? And in the meantime, you're waiting for,
I mean, they don't even do a really big so the disappearing building, which is memorable because it's really cool, but they're like showing off. It feels like people are showing off. It feels like some company came along after T2 and was like, well, we can do that too. Look at this room where things are invisible. The CG is not ambitious. And I think that's always been something about Carpenter, is that, you know, the CG in Escape from LA sucks. It's not something that he has a feel for. And I mean, that's pretty clear. When you think about The Thing, you've got, you know, model makers, you've got makeup guys, and he has a feel for that. And so it just doesn't transcend to how he does integrate special effects. So there's no big moment with Chevy Chase turning invisible where it's something really cool. It's him picking up a phone. It's terrible.
Most big CG movies have like big set piece moments that they lead up to, and this one feels like it just gets it out of the way at the beginning when you see him chew gum in his introduction. Like, how do I prove I'm invisible? Oh, I'll chew gum. And then the building. Yeah, there's no, I mean, because in the original Invisible Man, they make you wait 20 whole minutes before you see the invisibility. And then, I don't know, even with in Carpenter's own, you know, special effects movies, The Thing gets a big set piece moment. Christine gets a big set piece moment.
Big Trouble in Little China has a huge set piece moment.
In this, it never does get ambitious enough. I mean, I guess their other big moment besides the two we mentioned are like, what, the scene where he puts makeup on. So it's kind of like a makeup face mask of Chevy Chase talking to Daryl Hannah so she can see his face. And it feels creepy. And he looks like he walked off the set of Tourist Trap. And Daryl Hannah's like, oh, it's so good to see your face, Nick. Like, it looks bizarre and uncanny and terrifying, lady.
He has white out on his teeth.
You're really that into this guy, are you? Okay.
I mean, it seems like this is actually prime for a remake, just because it's been, what, almost 20 years since the book, so it can be, you know, the 80s thing, and I don't know. And you would have somebody who is committed to it as something other than a vehicle. Well, the other, when you mentioned the cat thing, it almost seems like it was played for more of a comedy. And this brings in the whole CIA aspect. The whole CIA. Oh, God, it's awful. Well, it's so bad.
I haven't even given you time to disparage Sam Neill like I know you're about to.
All I'll say is, if it weren't for Stephen Tobolowsky, who I usually love, Sam Neill would give the worst performance in the movie. But, I mean, even, you know, he's not very good in it. But, you know, he's not as bad as he's been in other stuff.
He's Sam Neill. He's a trooper. He's very dependable. It's very dependably Sam Neill.
Yeah, that whole subplot about the CIA trying to turn him into an agent, Sam Neill having this – maybe it's just because –
I hate to – yeah.
Well, no, because, you know, I watch Homeland, so I have some idea of realistic CIA business or, you know, at least sensible-sounding CIA business, that it just seems so absurd in this. It seems very slapstick. He's got this team of mean morons who run around with him. Like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, his goons are kind of noticeably buffoonish. And I kind of felt like that was, as goofy as it was more interesting than the Chevy Chase romance plot that was being balanced against it. Because it's him and Daryl Hannah again. For the first time.
Well, yeah, that's just because
it's so part of the Chevy Chase formula. It hurts.
Having like, the big invisibility set pieces involve her, like they're dating or whatever. It seems like a waste of money. Like the scene where they paint the face on, that comes back at the end when he puts on blackface, which...
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. Doesn't it feel a little like Darkman at the end when Sam Neill and Chevy Chase are up there on the girders? And if Chevy were wearing the traditional Invisible Man bandages, which he does in one scene, then it would be even more like Darkman.
Yeah.
You know, Darkman's a good example of a special effects movie where, you know, Darkman, hey, he kind of looks like the Invisible Man and the bandages. So you get like big reveal moments, one of the special effects kind of set piece moments is like when he's freaking out and his face kind of melts off in public when he sees, you know, Durant. Nothing like that. Not enough of that in this.
Well, no, and the ending, I vaguely remembered how it ended, but I'd forgotten how lame it is that the big showdown between Sam Neill and Chevy Chase is Chevy Chase holding out his invisible coat that Sam Neill can see because of the dust. And it's just so lame. I mean, it's just like, oh, Sam Neill runs for it. There's no...
Sam Neill is a moron, basically, who can be tricked by a jacket being tossed off the side.
I mean, if they'd really done, you know, they really should have done. I don't think Chevy Chase would have allowed it, but can you imagine if Joe Dante had directed this like he directed Gremlins 2?
Or even Innerspace, you know?
Well, no, but I think if he'd kept Chevy Chase, he could have, like, softly mocked him throughout. The whole movie, like in the Gremlins 2, sort of like, well, no, because the end, like, imagine if it had been like the whole, yeah, we're really on topic this time, guys, by the way, that's how much we love Memoirs of Invisible Man. The Looney Tunes music for Wile E. Coyote going over the cliff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when he, I mean, sure. it belongs there. It's so... Oh, there's no sense of comic timing to it. And I feel like that, in some ways, even though Carpenter does have some really good shots in it, and In some ways, it's probably his priciest movie, or it looks the best of his pricier movies in the 90s. It looks better than Escape from LA by far. His total disinterest in the movie hurts it in so many ways. Just so many ways that you can just tell that he did not give a shit at all.
Yeah. Well, and then the year after this was like Body Bags, and then Village of the Damned remake, and then
in the Mouth of Madness, which
Mouth of Madness,
everybody
which I'm a
loves.
Fan of.
You're a fan of. I need to watch it again. And then Village of the Damned, which I just watched recently, and you know,
Escape from L.A., Vampires,
Ghosts of Mars, and then that's it. And of those, the two most personal, three most personal were probably Body Bags.
yeah, which says a lot.
In the
really
Mouth of Madness and Ghosts of Mars. Because Vampires.
Maybe Escape from L.A., he might tell you.
He might tell you, but I don't know if I'd believe him.
Memoirs really began the impersonal phase of his career.
Which sadly just ended. It was the stopping point of his career, that he just became so disinterested that he just stopped making movies. That's kind of downbeat. Damn.
Well, sorry, it's hard to be upbeat when you're talking about Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Although I'll say this, it makes me want to read the novel.
Yeah.
I'll probably check it out sometime.
It's like I said, it moves pretty fast. I mean, it's only 99 minutes, and it moves pretty fast. You know.
Yeah.
Probably because he doesn't turn invisible after this stupid introduction during his narration for 20 minutes, so you're waiting for that. Yeah. All right.
So speaking of novels, I hinted at this earlier. We're going to continue on the H.G. Wells kick, and we're going to take a look at two versions of The Island of Dr. Moreau, with The Island of Lost Souls from 1932, I think, and starring Charles Laughton and Bela Lugosi, and the 1996 version called, more accurately, The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I haven't seen, so it's going to be new to me.
Yeah.
Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando as Dr. Moreau. In a role, role that will live in infamy, I guess. So we'll see how bad that is, and that'll be in our next episode. So, in the meantime, check out our blogs, Cinemachine and The Stop Button, and also check out Andrew's other podcast, the Comics Fondle podcast, for his comics blog of the same name. And I guess with that, we will see you next episode. So thanks a lot, and thanks for listening.